I think we'll get started. The meeting of the Watersheds, Wetland, and Buffers Subcommittee will come to order. Thank you for attending, Representative Doty. Hopefully we will have other members come, and we could almost introduce everybody in the room, I think, but we know, I think everybody knows everybody here. So this is during the last legislative session, in the environmental finance bill, we passed a number of reports requirements. And the purpose of this hearing today is to hear some follow-up work after the session on how those reports are coming along, how some of the proposals that we did adopt, for example, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, working with the Minnesota Conservation Corps, how that's working. And then also a number of the Bowser programs integrate well with the federal farm programs, and we'll be hearing from federal representative from NRCS on how the farm bill will be interacting with that. And then finally, we had passed some changes relating to reporting financial disclosure for some of the local government units, and we have a memo from the Campaign Finance Board that is all in your packet there that you can look at. So I don't believe we can actually approve minutes, even if we wanted to and had a quorum. But with that, I will ask Mr. John Jasky to come forward and start going through the number of reports that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. As the Chairman mentioned, there were several requirements for the bar agency to develop reports back to the legislature this upcoming session, and I'll cover those first, and I'll go into some of the other things that you mentioned regarding the status of various programs and some of the new programs that the legislature authorized. And so I'll start with the report. The first one is these aren't necessarily any order, but the first one that I'll refer to is a feedlot needs assessment report. We'll have more details on that certainly when the report's ready, but the genesis of that was that we've got, since 2000, a process with some mandates in it to deal with water pollution that potentially comes from animal livestock operations of various types. That began as a package in 2000, and there was a goal of having it basically completed in about 2010. And we're getting closer to the end of that than the beginning now, and the report will look at where we've been, what some of the needs still are, and how we might address those needs with some various ways of funding that. Certainly the change that occurred last session was to use some clean water legacy funding to accomplish that, and that's being rolled out. It already has been rolled out. We have that program working basically the same way it did in the past, where the landowners are providing 25% of the cost, and the public dollars are paying for 75% of the cost to upgrade those livestock facilities. We also very often utilize federal money, federal USDA money. Mr. Kohler here can talk about that a little more if necessary, but we use that money combining with the state money and the landowner money to address those problems. So the report will be ready January 1st. That's actually due. We probably will get it to you sometime thereafter whenever you're ready for it. We're doing that assessment with our Department of Agriculture, the Pollution Control Agency, who does the regulatory programs. We also have many counties that have delegated programs that oversee those regulations at the county level, and they're all part of this assessment to identify both the progress achieved so far as well as the continued need in the future. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. We will have Al Kane, our chief engineer, here before this committee and others to explain the details of that report after January 1st.
Mr. Jasky, at the end of the last session, as the feedlot water quality grants were being debated on the floor, there was data provided about which counties had received it, how many dollars per county over the past few years. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of a data analysis going to be included in the report?
Mr. Members, yes, we do have very good information about the past expenditures of feedlot water quality cost share dollars. One of the things, though, is to project how we're going to look forward as much as backward. And there are, you know, the number of feedlots are decreasing. That's the general trend. But the size of the number of animals in those has gotten larger. Consolidation has occurred. But still, I think the number was that 88% of the feedlots are under 300 animal units or under. So there's still a large number of them out there. The larger ones tend to have many of the provisions in place to manage the water quality issues. Many more, but smaller ones are the ones that are probably the biggest challenge looking ahead. So we will look back, but probably spend as much time, if not more, looking ahead in this report, trying to project where we're going in the future.
And finally, on that, have the Board of Water and Soil Resources worked with the farm groups on this process of preparing the report?
Yeah, we've gotten, there's a pretty regimented process in place for reporting of these feedlot operations and their status to the county level. And then the Pollution Control Agency also keeps a repository of the programs that they are overseeing. We've worked with both Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, and milk producers to get some information from them. I don't have all the details, but they've been part of our development of a draft report, so I expect they'll be interested in coming before the committee and talking about that report as well. Next, and I'm sorry.
One quick question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jasky, the upgrading that you talked about a few minutes back, the 25%, 75%, would that be something that farmers get notified about? They have to track this down on their own, or how is that publicized?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Doty, the way it works is they're to come into the county office, typically if they're the regulatory authority, and sign an agreement that says, I'm a feedlot operator owner, and by doing so it makes them eligible for these cost share dollars. Then your question though is a good one. How do they become aware of the specific opportunities and when they're available? And those are handled through our Soil and Water Conservation District offices, and they work very closely with the counties. The Soil and Water Conservation District end up prioritizing their applications based on a state-driven formula that has to do with pollution potential, let's call it that, and based on locations of water and other things. And it's a program we know as FLEVOL, okay, it's a program that you put some data in and it generates basically the pollution potential risk for that site, and they're prioritized based on that as one primary factor, the other primary factor being location to water. And so we end up not funding all those that are interested, certainly, but we try and pick out the ones that have the most pollution potential first. I'll go on to the next report, which is the requirement that that our agency oversee the organizational effectiveness of local water management authorities. There was some new policy language passed last session based on, in large part, on a legislative auditor report that outlined a more systematic and regular oversight of those organizations, and we've put together a proposal that we'll be implementing over the course of the next year. We will have in this report back to this committee and others some assessment we've done already, but it'll be fairly minimal because we've just gotten this thing launched. We've involved our local government partners. We've also involved research in other areas that have done this kind of systematic, performance assessment, probably the best way to describe it. We also, though, are going to make sure that we have assistance available, too, because if we've got some that are underperforming, and the goal is to identify it early, to come up with ideas about how to correct it and have the state help them get ready to do the best job they can and follow the statutory provisions that are part of their responsibilities, as well as any grant conditions or those things that they may have responsibility for. In the case of Soil and Water Conservation District, they got some funding to develop websites, and the majority of them have accomplished that. There will be hopefully all of them having done that by the early 2008. That will be an important part of being able to have citizens participate in those decision-making events and understand what services are available through the Soil and Water Conservation District and the watershed districts. So we'll have that report available in February of 2008. One of the handouts you have there is a kind of a set of principles that we've used as an agency to follow as we develop that program. And we've changed the name of it now from oversight to actually performance review and assistance. That's the name of the program because it's important that it do both, that it provide an assessment of their performance as well as provide a opportunity to help them out when they're needing help. So it's on the back side, perhaps, of a handout that hopefully the administrator thing will put in your packet. Nine principles. We are one short of ten, but that's okay. We're going to stop at nine. And I should mention, too, as a component of that, on your agenda here, you note that there was a demographic survey of Stormwater Conservation District and Watershed District officials that we did. That information has been pulled together in a nearly final draft, and we will have that included in the in this report as an appendix, so you'll be able to see some demographic information about those individuals.
Mr. Daske, we seem to be searching for it and may not have.
Review these real quick. I mean, they're, the important parts here are that we identify any problems that are out there early so that we can go into exploration of how to correct them. And the only way we can be preemptive, as the first principle describes, is to be systematic so that we're out doing this assessment regularly and consistently rather than, you know, trying to predict where problems are or only react to where problems are identified. The other ones, you know, have to do with making sure that we acknowledge that each local government has got their own priorities, uniquenesses, and citizen expectations. We want to make sure that they can acknowledge those while, you know, making sure that they're available for citizens to engage in their processes and have other transparency factors in place. If there are problems, we've got to fix them, and if they don't fix them, there's consequences. That's part of the legislation that was passed in 2007. And so you can, you know, read on here, but these are the principles that we're using to put this program in place. And I should mention that we have a one-time appropriation for the 2 years of $100,000 to do this. So we've hired a program coordinator with that funding, and that person was the first person that we actually hired out of the new appropriation. His name is Don Buckhouse, and he'll be here before this committee, I'm sure, in the future to explain the process and the results of the work we've done thus far. So I look forward to bringing him along with me at an upcoming hearing. Okay, I'll keep going then. Mr. Chairman, members, the other one is on a green sheet. If you got a green sheet, then you'll know you've got the right piece of paper. Maybe I should have color-coded all of these. But another program, or it was at least envisioned and a report required, which dealt with this clean energy idea about growing natural vegetation for cellulosic ethanol production. And the legislation required Bowser to develop or to convene a committee, a review committee of various interest groups, and to then put together a proposal that would, you know, basically do two things. One, it would lay out the payment rates for conservation easements that would be put onto lands that would make be made available for this bioproduction to begin. So you'd start growing grasses where you're previously growing something else. Forbs, et cetera, may also be part of the mix. But the idea was to stimulate that development of those plant communities in areas where you had facilities ready to bring it to market. So that was the other part of this, was to identify the areas, pilot areas, mind you, that would be ready to make this all come together. And the process that we envision for that will be an RFP kind of approach, where we announce that this is a proposal that we want interested parties to develop ideas on. I'm sure it'll be collaborative efforts, because you need the production facility, you need the local governments, you need the landowners all ready to do this together, and that if funding is forthcoming in the legislative bonding bill appropriation, that then some of this would begin beginning this coming summer. And those plants that are ready to do this would then expect to be able to access this amount of biomass for their facilities at some point in the future once these areas are up and thriving. The current approach has sort of a three-tiered payment system based on the kind of vegetation that would be established. The first type is the most basic, which is more of a monotype of perennial vegetation that would be available for harvest. The second tier would be some more middle ground native vegetation mix that has a a relatively modest number of species in it. And the third tier would be the one that was sort of a piece that came out of the Tillman paper that talked about a many-species mix of native plants that would be available for biofuel production potentially longer term. So that's the status of this work. It is going through one more technical review committee meeting in January, and then a report will be forthcoming from our board in late January, and the legislative bodies will be able to review and read those recommendations about the 1st of February. So that's the status of that report.
Mr. Jaskey, on the tiers, are they, it sounds like they're based on the seed or the crop that would be growing. Was there any discussion on timing of harvest and that effect on wildlife and or carbon sequestration?
Chairman, the answer is yes to both of those. This has been an interesting project because there's so many different perspectives and benefits. Actually, you get the benefit of biofuel production, but you also get the benefit of conservation practices on the land. But how and when the harvest occurs is an important factor in the benefits you derive. So, as you know, certainly under the Tier 3, there's a harvest. All of these have a harvest expectation. The question is how often and at what point in the year can you begin that harvest? And so, yes, there is that factor built into each of these tiers. I don't have the exact dates, but certainly that will be part of the report. The other thing that's being talked about, we haven't quite nailed down yet, is whether sort of landscape position or location on the land should be a factor as well, and whether the tier would be 1, 2, or 3. Because certainly some areas have a greater opportunity to provide conservation benefits than others, but it also might compromise the ability to go in and harvest the material. So we've got to weigh and balance those two somewhat or potentially competing criteria. So there's more to come on that one as well. And of course, this is all dependent on an appropriation from the bonding bill to go and acquire these conservation easements. We also, and maybe Mr. Kohler will mention his report, but the new farm bill that's been passed in both the House and the Senate at the congressional level, each have a bioenergy component in there. In fact, the name of the bill, I think, Tim, was give it to me again, but it had to do with food, nutrition, and bioenergy, I think, was the name of the actual bill itself. Okay, farm nutrition, I'm sorry. So this is an important part of that, and we're hoping to have Minnesota ready to access some of those new federal dollars that might be available under that farm bill, you know, depending on when it gets passed. So that's an important part of this as well. So with that, I'll conclude my comments on this item.
Any questions on RIM Clean Energy? Okay, proceed.
Okay. Let me tackle, this is in the report necessarily, but it almost ends up taking the same form, and that's the Administrative Penalty Order Authority. In the 2007 session, again, there was Administrative Penalty Order Authority provided to the agency, and there's a diagram in your packet that's got a diagram actually on both sides. One has got the handwritten note of current on the upper left corner, and that's the one I'm going to talk about first. But this authority was provided to our agency broadly across all of our statute responsibilities, but with the expectation that we use it under the Wetland Conservation Act program first, because that's the primary program we administer that has a significant enforcement component. That program currently has sort of three tracks that are available that we use to achieve compliance, and they all end up, they all start with an order that is issued by typically a DNR conservation officer to fix a problem on the ground that, you know, needs to get fixed. Someone hasn't gotten the proper authorities, or if they've gotten the authorities, they haven't complied with them properly. We've got three tracks. We've got an administrative track, which is currently in place, where our agency hears appeals of decisions made by others as an administrative appeal body. It's set up that way in statute because it's very cost-effective and hopefully quicker than going through a court system, but some of them still take a bit of time to resolve. We also will use the current criminal authorities, and that's the way this has worked for the last 15 or more years since the law was passed in 1991, where violators of these orders ultimately go to a court, and the court determines guilt, and if they do, the court then puts in place a penalty, which could be, you know, both a combination of, it's a misdemeanor, by the way, so they could be up to 90 days in jail, and we've had a couple of people actually have to do that, not because of our agency directly, but because of a violation of the court order to fix something that they don't then go fix on the ground. However, that's time-consuming, and certainly it doesn't always work either, because not all violations necessarily rise to the level of a criminal intent being able to be proven. And the other option here of a civil action requires that the Attorney General's office, you know, go ahead and pursue a civil case against typically an individual landowner, which is very, very rare, and we haven't actually had that happen in the 15 years that this program has been in place. So what this administrative penalty order authority requires us to do is create another opportunity or pathway for getting the on-the-ground results that are necessary to do the restitution and remediation, et cetera. And if ultimately the landowner doesn't comply, then there's a process for a collection of fines and a way for the agency to accomplish that restoration itself. We are using a model that currently is in law that the Pollution Control Agency uses and for their enforcement of some of their programs. We've built a proposal that, you know, I'm not going to give you all the details, but if you turn the page over there, it kind of outlines the way this works. The difference is that we have this criminal process. We want to make sure we don't compromise, and we also have to make very, very sure we have significant or sufficient due process for landowners who would be subject to these orders, because, we've got to be careful that we're always right and that this is the only option left is to force compliance through one of these orders. So we've got a draft prepared. We will have a final version of this in place in April for the field season and be able to exercise this authority then if and when it's warranted. One of the things that we have a challenge with, of course, is that although there are some fines that ultimately may be collected, they do not go back to the agency directly. They go to the general fund, and so we'll need to have a conversation about how to provide the resources to the front-end work to get these orders in place before that compliance or collection of fees ultimately occurs. So that's the status of our work on that, and we'll be happy to report back the details as they progress.
Mr. Daske, I think at the previous meeting of the full committee, we asked about kind of looking at a summary from counties, if there were patterns in counties where maybe there could be enforcement actions, but there might be reluctance on taking action. And for example, if a neighboring county has X number, but there's zero in the other county. I don't know if you were able to compile that, or if you could compile that.
We are in the process of compiling it. I'll say that we should have that ready probably by beginning of the legislative session. We're getting it from two sources. One, we get it from our conservation officers who keep records of the cease and desist orders or the restoration orders where these things precipitate from. But then the other question is how many of them actually get to a district court, and then what's the outcome there? So that's a little bit harder to track down. So we're tracking that down. We should have that information hopefully early in 2008.
And to follow up, I think that the DNR had testified earlier this fall that they were going to be doing some flyovers, and if the proposed process for the administrative penalty orders is going to be done in April, could you maybe go over what's happened in the last month or two just with DNR going up in the air and flying over and how that relates to interaction with Bowser or the local U.S. government?
structure. I can tell you how it works. You know, I don't have all the details on which places they flew, because they've flown parts of different areas of the state. Some they went back to and re-flew just to kind of verify and set some trends. Others they went in and did some flights over areas they hadn't gone before. The way it works, though, is once they do that, they identify a potential violation. Actually, what they identify is an impact to a wetland. You know, it may or may not have been authorized, or may or may not be in compliance. And so then there's this ground truthing effort that has to take place, which requires connecting the observations from the airplane with the administrative decisions that have been made or not made on the ground. If the work has been authorized and there's already a permit per se in place to take care of it, then of course it's checked off as having been compliant. If not, then that's where the work of the local government comes into play. The Stormwater Conservation District often is the primary agent that goes out and does the investigation about how much of the activity is non-compliant, and then prepares a technical order that is issued by the conservation officer to remedy that situation. That's the restoration order that we talk about. And so the work of that is done by the Stormwater Conservation District, and they give it to the officer who issues it. And so then that's where this whole process begins, and that's where this tool could be one of the ways to achieve compliance rather than going through the court system. From our perspective, of course, when the courts are dealing with it, then they're having to pay for it and do the administrative work, understandably, maybe more costly on a per unit basis than it would be for the administrative agency to do it. But of course, that means that, you know, if we're asked to do it, then we've got to make choices about not doing other things too, unless we have new resources to accomplish it. So that's the way the process works on the ground. The DNR then, once the restoration order is issued, then if compliance is achieved, then they basically issue an order of compliance saying you've done it. If they don't, then that's where they go, in this current case, to the district court or to the county attorney to get the district court to consider prosecution. And in this case now, we would be able to go to the administrative agency to see if they could pursue it. Now, we've got to make sure that those two things are coordinated, because which one goes first is an important part of giving landowners clear ways to work towards resolution, as well as not compromising legal principles about civil versus criminal orders being issued. So, and I don't have all those details. We're working through those connections in this process that I referred to earlier.
Follow up, Representative
McGee. I am troubled by the assumption that it would take more to do an administrative penalty order on your part than to do anything else. It seems to me that preparation is identical. You have to show the facts on the ground. Mm-hmm. And you have to prepare your case, no matter what. You have to prepare your case at a much higher level if it's criminal. Probably at a much higher level if you have to take it to a county attorney's office. So between a cease and desist order and an ATO, probably identical. So I think maybe having some conversations with people who have done APOs would be helpful, because I think you would come to the conclusion that it is not additional workload over and above what you're doing right now.
Well, I think that, Mr. Chairman and Representative Genius, it may not be in a collective sense, but for our agency, I believe it would be, for one simple reason alone, and there's others, I believe, which is when a order is issued, you know, by an agency, there's an appeal process that requires an ALJ to be hearing that matter, and the agency needs to pay for that hearing now, whereas when it goes to criminal court, there's a judge or a jury, they make the decision that is paid for out of the district court budgets. So it's a cost shift, I think. It may not be overall a different cost. It may actually be less, but it's a cost shift onto the administrative agency in some way, shape, or form. We will be evaluating how much. It may not be, insurmountable, but we haven't been able to determine that yet.
If I could follow up, do you think you've had more than a handful of criminal cases in this last year?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we have.
That have actually gone to trial?
Well, I'm getting the data on that, but I'm sure we've had more than a dozen. If you, I don't know how many of the many, but I'm looking into the data that we have from our restoration orders that have been issued, and then how many of them have gone to trial is the information we're collecting as we speak. So I don't know yet, but I'll have an answer for you early in the year.
Should ask you just to maybe follow up on that. Are most of those the result of previous flyovers, or are they complaint-driven?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the breakdown, but we have many restoration orders that were being issued before the flyovers occurred, so they just added to the number that were probably out there. How many more? I don't have any idea. You know, if it's a 10% increase or 20%, but I wouldn't say it's any more than that.
Maybe if I clarify, of the dozen or so that actually went to court, went to trial, are those from complaints, or are those from flyovers?
Mr. Chairman, that I don't know, and I'll make a note to see if we can discern that from the information we're collecting about those that went to trial.
Okay, and then to maybe go in a different direction, since the fall when this issue has come up, what outreach efforts have occurred between UNDNR and maybe some of the local units of government?
Mr. Chairman, we had a meeting up at Camp Ripley where the DNR has got some headquarters, and we walked through the process for how this works, because as you mentioned, there are several components to it. I think we've got a plan now that can digest the amount of work that might be put onto any one local government administratively. DNR has some additional funding to help that along as well. I don't know, to be honest, how much of that they've utilized or how much they plan to this spring. Certainly, the times that they have the most successful flyovers is in the late fall, when a lot of work is done and leaves are off, and also in the spring when leaves off again occur. So I expect they'll be doing the bulk of their flying in the spring and fall.
Any other questions? We proceed.
Okay. I think what I'll do, Mr. Chairman, is cover the Southeast Minnesota flood relief issue, because that's something we've been spending a lot of time on. Had anticipated that, of course, during the 2000 session when you were dealing with all the other things, but the special session that occurred provided some dollars through our agency to local governments and landowners for flood relief on two fronts. One, on the conservation erosion control program, our TASHA program, that allowed us to provide funds to go in and restore some of the major bank failures and stream bank erosion sites that occurred down in that seven county area. There's two handouts. One is, I got a set of photographs that was part of a presentation that was made earlier today to our board. Some of them show the damages, some of them show the repairs. The other piece of paper that's in front of you or available to you, there is a summary of the dollars. It's got a logo up in the upper right-hand corner. This reflects the portion of that $3 million that's been allocated and spent, how much of it has been allocated and pending, and how much of it remains. The good news is we tried to get as much of this out as we could as fast as possible, recognizing that as soon as we got into conditions like we're seeing now with freeze up and snow, we wouldn't be able to do any more, and that those areas that were able to be protected are going to be, you know, in good standing when the spring snow melts and other high water events occur. So a big chunk of the money went to that big project in Minnesota City. Mr. Kohler can talk about the federal contribution there. Something we've been using the principles as follows in terms of which projects we put money into. The first is we ask for all participants to make sure they've utilized any insurance claims that they would have received for those projects. Second in line is to utilize federal disaster relief funding. And then third in line is our state funding. So that's the principles that we use, as well as the other agencies who work through the Minnesota Recovery Task Force to bring relief down to this area. So in this case, for example, the Minnesota City site, you can see the dollars there. The total project cost ended up being $630,000, and the NRCS, Mr. Kohler's agency, put in $472,000, or actually $473,000. And what we did is, at the state then, Minnesota City actually put the remainder of that cost in initially to get the project started, and then we reimbursed the city with the state cost share fund. So that project has been complete. You can see the scale of it there. There's also been some work to remove debris upstream in this area as well as others, so that, as you can imagine, in a flood like this, there's lots of trees and other debris that get jammed up into the stream banks, and getting that out before the spring runoff was another major priority for a number of the stormwater conservation districts and other local governments. So another project down there you can see in the lower left-hand corner of page 2 in Houston County. You can see when this damage occurred right after the leaves were on, and you can see they got the thing done with all the leaves off, so it was just before the snow and all that came, so they were able to get that project done in fairly short order. You can see that we paid actually, you know, the bulk of the project. One of the things that happened in that special session was that there were waivers made to the existing state law and rule about the cost share proportions and other things that allowed us to bring the money down there quickly and get the project built quickly without having to be so concerned about the proportion of where the funding was coming from, other than that point about using federal money before state money, or insurance money and federal money before state money. So we've still got some needs to be met down there. Our estimate is that we need about another $1.45 million to finish off the projects that have been identified thus far, as well as provide the technical assistance. And the other thing that would be helpful is to extend the time period that these funds are available, because they are now only available through June 30th of 2008, and if we could dig an extension of that for a year or two, that would be very helpful in being able to complete some of these projects. So that's where we're at with the cost share funds. There's also a couple situations where federal money couldn't be used because some of the work was done before they applied for the assistance, and that's a principle the state cost share program has in place too, generally, where you can't forgive someone money for work that they've already completed. But in this case, people were just trying to keep anything stable for as long as they could before someone could give them help. And the good news was that our state legislature allowed those waivers so that we could, you know, not sort of penalize folks for actually having to do something quickly before it was all able to be taken care of later. So we've been able to fund some projects that the federal funds were no longer eligible to tap into. So, and finally, we've also had a reinvest in Minnesota conservation easement program that we've started down there, basically to go in and offer landowners conservation easements on lands that were so damaged that there's no way they can be put back into cropland or other use. So that sign-up period goes into January. So we're taking applications now. We have $1 million that was appropriated for that purpose, and we also allocated another $1.1 million from existing funds for that purpose. And we don't have any numbers on that yet because the sign-up is still underway. Finally, there's some good local and federal and state relationships being built about how to prevent this from happening in the same way that it did this time. Now, everyone knows you can't stop 17 inches of rain on a landscape like that, but being prepared for it and minimizing the damage is the goal. The NRCS has brought some planning dollars into the mix, as well as the state funds, and the locals have stepped up and leading that. In fact, the mayor of Minnesota City is chairing one of these groups trying to figure out how to prevent this from happening again, recognizing that it's not just they're a little city, but they understand the watershed approach to managing these problems, and they're leading that effort. You can see that there's a meeting that's going to be held on April 2nd, a kind of a big forum of the whole Southeast to talk about collectively how we can be as well prepared as possible next time, but also to make sure we understand what's left to do and how to do it for the relief that's still needed down in that part of the state. So April 2nd on Friday, they're going to have a large gathering to talk about some of those things. The agenda has not been set, but they've identified the location and the date now. So I'll end there and answer any questions the folks might have. And I know a couple of you got to tour parts of this area earlier this year, and so you saw some of this firsthand.
Any questions? Mr. Jaskey, on the summary of the dollars, it has the $3 million appropriation $812,000 that's been allocated.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that's money that's been paid to the contractors and the cost shares. Those are closed and done. And then we have $1.2 million pending and about $976,000 available.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what available means? Is that...
Sure. Mr. Chairman, available means that those funds are not yet identified for a specific project. When we say none of the money gets allocated until a specific project is identified, so this amount of money is still available. The way this works is we send out an initial allocation without having specific projects identified and ask these local stormwater conservation districts to do that. They did that, and of course all that money was gone very quickly, and that's what helped get some of those projects done before the freeze-up occurred. There's some larger scale projects which then they've identified, which is in the pending status. The 976 is basically available for projects that are being identified as we speak and through the remainder of until the money's gone, basically. And the Minnesota Recovery Task Force is the place where those decisions are coordinated, and then ultimately the projects that they've identified will all get funded until that money's gone, and then that's where our estimate of the 1.45 that's still needed is based on. So we expect this money to be allocated before the end of the fiscal year, well before that, and then some needs will still be unmet.
One of the things that struck, I believe, the bonding committee when we toured down there was the massive mudslides on hill slopes that may have crossed different property owner boundaries, or they moved from cropland into woodland and across the county road and different jurisdictions. And I think part of the goal of members was to get money out there and that some of those things could be stabilized, maybe not repaired, but stabilized before we got into the winter season. When you drive through the countryside there, you can see those large mudslides. Any update on that, or were some of those just very large and have to be dealt with next spring?
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, I don't know all the details on any one of them specifically, but the ones that they could deal with, now they did. You're right, though, that one of the other benefits of the waiver language was that it allowed us to not have to worry about ownership of the land so much, is allowing someone to take responsibility for the whole project and then having them be the contractor or the contracting agent that would take care of the problem. So in the case of a slide like you described, where it's a couple of landowners, even some public land involved, we could work with, in this case, the public agency, the road authority, to be the project sponsor. They could take care of the whole thing in one fell swoop rather than having to kind of piece it together. And that was another benefit of the waiver language that was put into the legislation. The way they worked it was everyone that they could get done, and there was, of course, some questions about contractor availability to get all this work done. Contractors are very busy down there trying to, do what they could. My understanding is they did all the ones they could. They tried to stabilize them temporarily as best they could, and then they'll come back to them, when they can again come spring. So.
And was there sufficient engineering capacity to get the project engineered before the contractors put projects in the ground?
And Chairman, it's a good question because, one of the reasons why we had the provision that you can't get paid to do some work before the project is reviewed and designed is that we can't pay for something that doesn't have a solid design behind it. That was a concern, actually, of getting enough people that could be out there getting the groundwork done to collect the data to give to the engineer to make the design. That's why our request for additional funds includes technical assistance dollars. And it also includes the request to extend the current appropriation so we can get people on board to do that kind of work, whether it's contractors or temporary employees, whatever it takes to be most cost-effective in doing the engineering work that it takes to tackle those large-scale projects.
And then finally, when one of our tours, we saw the Root River Trail that had been washed out by near the confluence of the Root River. And the Department of Natural Resources had a couple of proposals for redoing that, and have you worked with DNR on, or has your staff worked with DNR on that particular project? Because I think there were a number of questions among members on that particular project.
Mr. Chairman, I know the project you're talking about now that you mentioned it, but I don't know who was working on it. I just don't have that level of detail. Mary Kells is our person who's been working kind of on the ground down there, and I can check with her and get back to you on that.
Any questions?
Okay, I'll continue then. The next one is another topic that will generate a report, but not due until 2009, and that is the Northeast Weather Mitigation Strategy. There was an appropriation made to our agency to conduct, in concert with a number of local governments and other interests in the northeastern part of the state, a strategy to how to deal with their weather mitigation requirements most effectively up in that part of the state. As you know, it's a wetland-rich state, I mean a wetland-rich area of the state with very few opportunities to actually put a wetland where one would have been lost previously because they just didn't have that kind of landscape changes as other parts of the state have. And they've also got some large-scale efforts underway to expand mines and other things, and so how do they be prepared to mitigate those wetlands that are going to be impacted? We've had an RFP that went out. A contractor has been selected, actually a partnership of a private firm and the Natural Resource Research Institute up in Duluth, affiliated with the University of Minnesota Duluth. They're the partnership that's working on this project. We're going to have a kind of a kickoff meeting up there on January 25th. I think it'll be in Grand Rapids, and we'll let this committee and other members know about that if they choose to be part of that. But we think that's a very important step in helping them deal with their wetland mitigation needs and issues up in that part of the state. And I know, I think it'll be in the end a very cost-effective investment because we'll know where to put the wetlands to get the most benefits, but recognizing that some of them will necessarily be impacted, especially by these large-scale mining and some road building things that are going to be going on up there over the next number of years. So that's the status on that one.
Any questions?
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, if you would, I'll just mention briefly a couple of new programs that are underway. Most of them are tied to additional emphasis on native seed and native plant management that came out of a couple of appropriations as well as some policy language this past session. The first one is the County Weed Management Cooperative. The legislature appropriated some money for that program. Our board just approved today the process for getting interested parties. Usually, and the way this works with a cooperative is a collection of local governments, soil and water conservation districts, counties, it could even be township, rural authorities, and state agencies, the DNR, the MnDOT, Department of Agriculture through their weed inspector program. So it's a matter of figuring out the best way to collectively manage preventing or eradicating our invasive species and that we see cropping up in various places on public land, private land, road ditches. It's based on a model that was very successful in Clay County. They included even the nonprofits and the federal agencies as well as some of the herbicide companies also contributed to that effort. So they included quite a few different participants. And so our proposal is to put this out and seek collaborative efforts that want to do this same sort of thing in different places around the state. We expect that we'll get on the order of maybe 8 to 10 of them that will be successful in their proposal and get funded and get startup funding to carry that forward. We're looking at between $35,000 and $70,000 per successful application, I guess. So we'll have that out in January, and most governments will be able to tap that money come March. So that's about eradicating the bad stuff for the most part. Okay, the other program is the Native Buffer Cost Share program, which is about getting more of the good stuff, the native species growing, and it targets riparian buffer areas. That's where this program is emphasizing is establishing. We're looking to do this in a piggyback fashion where it makes sense onto lands that are either going to be enrolled or are enrolled in either conservation easements already, and this would be a way to come in and accelerate or enhance the plant community that would be established in that area. This is a program that requires a high level of, how shall we say, enhancement, because we're looking at the 25 species mix that has to be part of this. We're looking at, you know, that the yellow tag approach to identifying the source of the seed is all following the new provisions that were put in statute the past session. Among the goals of the program are to obviously achieve water quality and habitat benefits of establishing, you know, riparian buffers, but also to, you know, incent development and expansion of the native species seed mixes that are going to be available. So hopefully expand the harvestable areas long term as these areas continue to be established or enhanced in some cases. One thing that we're doing different than the in our traditional cost share program is we're extending the practice and requirement to 15 years and 10 years because this is it takes a while to get these established, and once they're established, we want them to be there hopefully forever. But at minimum, we need a landowner to commit to a 15-year maintenance responsibility. I guess I can leave it at that, but we expect this to be before our board in January and available to our Soil and Water Conservation District and their interested partners shortly thereafter. So I'll answer any questions I can.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I'm glad to see you working on this. I hope if we, as you're talking to people, and I certainly get this from you, that you'll be talking to them about having seeds that they can in turn sell or move along, expand. Because that's the state's interest in having these local ecotypes. But when I read your proposal, you have gone beyond the local ecotype to the ecotype region, and that's not what the statute said. The statute said just local ecotype. So it would be the source within a county or 25 miles of a county border in the same ecotype region. And the reason for that is because we have so few local ecotypes, and we're trying to expand that. We just have so little in this state. And if we're going to go into major provision to put local ecotypes on rim lands, et cetera, I mean, that's why we did it. So we didn't do the historic prairie source within the same ecotype region. That's very different than what the statute says. So maybe you need to have your folks check on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll look at that more carefully. This is a draft that this has not been adopted at this point, but I wanted to share with you the draft that we've been working from. As we discussed, you know, originally we had thought that we were going to need to develop rules to implement this program because that's the way our cost share programs have been put in place. But as you just mentioned, you know, the legislation actually put in place enough of a standard for us to not have to develop rules before we could roll this out. So we're using our existing rules that define the administrative aspects of the program. We're using the legislation to identify the eligibility criteria. So I'll go back and double check on that. The other thing I should mention is that once we get this finalized, we're going to be conducting a series of training sessions around the state to bring the experts who know this stuff, our staff as well as folks in other agencies, to help local governments as well as private sector folks understand the opportunity and how this works and get more people understanding and educated about how this can work. And even though I think there's still quite a few folks out there in the landscape that don't have all the knowledge about this program, we need to make sure that training is in place. I've got one of our staff folks, Dan Shaw, who's developed a compendium of all the current seed mixes, and he's going to be able to go out and be a primary instructor in how to make this work, make it viable. We're also going to need to rely a great deal on these private vendors to provide the seed source and even some services to get the seed established, because that's not something that everyone's set up to do.
Thank you. I'm glad you're working with private vendors. Some folks who grow native species came to visit with me about 2 weeks ago, and one of the things they said was it's always been hard to plant and grow local ecotype speak because there hasn't been a market. And of course, that's what we're trying to provide, is the market. And they were excited that we actually were going to provide this market, and that we were being strict, because that is going to help them in the long run have a very defined seed which they can sell, that will sell well. So you also have some seed producers out there that are glad that we're being strict.
Mm-hmm.
Because they will also tell us, and they have been telling us, that when we, long time ago, brought seeds from Nebraska or whatever, and they established here and they look good, those prairies didn't last because they were not, those seeds were not viable. It just didn't grow in our region. The timing of the sunlight was wrong, and things happened and they just didn't maintain. So for long-term maintenance, and I'm really glad that's what you're going for, local ecotype is the only way we can be assured that it's long-term.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll do a couple, three more quick things, and then I'll let you get into your other presenters. I think they actually connect with some of those. One is, I know you'll probably want to talk about it more later, but our agency, like every agency does, has a legislative audit that looks at our financial and record-keeping systems, and we went through that process in early 2007, actually early 2007, and certainly they found some things we can do better on, and we're working on measures to deal with that. I think we'll have an opportunity to talk about the details of that if they're important, but certainly we know that the way we manage our finances and our record-keeping systems underpin all of our conservation programs, and so if those are in need of some enhancements or improvements, we deal with that just as importantly as we do with the program delivery. So I wanted to assure you of that.
I think we'll have a whole committee hearing on that probably the second or third day of session. I think we start on a Tuesday, and our normal day is a Wednesday, so we probably should be prepared for that Wednesday of going over the auditor's report.
Okay. And then the last two things are actually segues into the next two presenters. One, I want to acknowledge that the legislation that directed our agency to make a connection with the Minnesota Conservation Corps through the Clean Water Legacy Appropriation has been very successful in getting started. I think it actually led to some things that we didn't even anticipate, and I know that Mr. Price will be here to talk about a little bit of that, but that the recent annual meetings of the Stillwater Conservation District and Watershed District, a couple things struck me. One is there were a number of vendors there that were hadn't been there before. None of them were actually dealing with seed production. They're interested in communicating how they can bring their services to our local government partners. And secondly, I heard some comments about how the MCC crews have been very cost-effective and terrific in the work they did in the southeastern area, in the flood area, and we expect to see more of that in the future. So one more point I want to make is in your packet, and I'll let Mr. Kohler talk more about it, but there's a colored sheet here that describes the current status of our CRP contract, which is a major conservation program that the U.S. Farm Bill funds. That funding will, and that program actually will come to an end at the end of the calendar year, and depending on the new Farm Bill, it will hopefully come back. But regardless, these conservation contracts, these are contracts now, 10 to 15 year contracts, are expiring. So that short-term conservation that was on these lands is going to be gone in most cases, because even if there is new funding, the current payment rates are not sufficient to entice people to enroll anymore, because they can do better with commodity crop production. And so we're going to have a proposal, hopefully, that you'll be able to consider in the bonding bill to get funding to, in our Reinvest in Minnesota program, to preserve some of this, a very small portion, mind you, but hopefully the most important areas that are coming out of short-term conservation, and keep them in long-term conservation before they get converted back to production. And of course, working in a voluntary way with landowners, but we also And Mr. Kohler will tell you that the Wetland Reserve Program, WRP, is also one that the funding and the end of that comes at the calendar year, and hopefully some new funding will come with that. But even in that program, again, can't work without state contribution to supplement it to make those wetland restoration projects happen. And so the second page kind of shows this timeline issue that we face, which is we have a biennial effort typically for the bonding bill, and we have these federal fiscal year appropriations that come along, and our challenge is to make sure we line these up to take advantage of each other in the most productive manner possible. And you can see that in this diagram, we're hoping, and maybe, and we'll see what happens, that $40 million will be available at the federal level over the next two fiscal years for the WRP program, and we'd be able to access state money to match that to get those projects accomplished. And so we'll have more conversation about this as part of the bonding bill proposals, and you can see how these programs line up. But I'll leave it to Mr. Kohler to talk about the USDA Farm Bill. If you have any more questions for me about how our programs relate, I'll be happy to come back here and explain that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next presenter is Len Price, Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservation Corps.
A couple things that you could maybe be distributed here.
Welcome to the committee, Connor.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for the invitation to come and visit today. Always glad to talk about what we're doing, and nice to hear that the Board of Water and Soil Resources pleased with our work, and that they've heard some of the same phrases for our crews as we've heard. I have to just say that, in a nutshell, the partnership with Bowser is going very, very well. It took us some time after the session ended to set up the nuts and bolts procedures of how we would make this work. We had great cooperation from the staff at Bowser. We've established a procedure that involves both Bowser staff and MCC project managers to help determine which projects seem to have the viability and the wherewithal for us to address with our crews, and that's worked very well. It was one of the first things that we had to do was try to get the information out that this $500,000 appropriation that you decided to allow to occur was money that was available to the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and Watershed Districts of WMOs who were involved in impaired waters, that we were indeed a cost-effective workforce that could be contracted to perform some of the projects that would be in the pipeline. And we had, I think, about 40 or 39 applications this fall. We set a date of September 15th by which we would like to have the application submitted. We felt that was a reasonable amount of time so that we could actually, once the decision was made, do some of the work this fall. Out of that 39 or so, I think we've completed about 8 of them before the weather got to the point where we could not do the work. So we have several in the pipeline. That number of projects consumed about $220,000 of the $500,000 that was appropriated. I don't think we're going to have any difficulty expending the other $280,000 from the appropriation before the end of this biennium. The word is now out there in a much better and broader way than before, so there'll be other groups that will be forwarding proposals to us. We did have to deny some of them, both the Bowser staff and MCT staff, that they don't fit the criteria or it's not within the confines of the clean water or the parameters of the clean water legacy. We did send out, I think, about 260 communications to local government units advertising that we were available for this. In January of 2008, we will once again renew that mailing to them requesting the proposal. So we think that's going to work just well, very well. We do give monthly updates to Bowser about the use of the funds. currently there's not much going on because of the weather, and we will continue to communicate that to the staff at Belcher. I think we're required to report them every 6 months with a more formal report, but we have a very good ongoing relationship in relationship to that. In terms of anything else related to that, maybe I should just open it up for questions. I would have brought my project manager with me, but he snuck away for a Christmas break this morning at 8 o'clock. But these are we request a request form, and we have one for each of the projects. I'm not familiar with all of them. I scanned them the last couple of days in preparation for this hearing. We've done them here in the metro area and some outstate. Of course, it depends on where the endured water is, and we expect that more and more of them will probably come out of the southern part of the state since that work has been done in terms of the assessment. But the system that we've adopted seems to be working very well. I think we're pleased with that, and I think of other staff is too. So if you have any questions? Okay, and then you asked also if we could say something about our involvement with the floods in August in the southeastern part of the state. MCC crews were contacted from several people in several ways to try to provide some sort of first response and then secondly talk about restoration and remediation. I think our crews spent over 3,000 hours, some of which was paid for, some of which was voluntary. One of our mission components is to provide emergency response service and to do it in a voluntary way if we can, but of course, being a nonprofit, fee-for-service is an important element of our manner in which we do business. But we spent a lot of time, I know, from the crews in Rochester near Caledonia, Minnesota, working primarily with the DNR on some what I would term as real true early response and clearing and so on. The DNR has also asked us to consider a long-term commitment to Whitewater State Park. We thought we would be doing more work there. We did do some this fall, but we thought we would be doing much more work there. But the weather closed in, and there are some things in that park that even we can't tackle because there are some real dangerous things. There are trees that are standing up simply because the roots haven't deteriorated enough to let them fall over. And it's difficult to say that it's a safe situation to send anybody in there, but you do have to have some expertise in handling some of those things. And I think that the DNR, in talking to Cortland Nelson, needed some time to really think about what they would do kind of on a first tier, be ready to reopen the park if they could next spring, and then more long-term kinds of things. So I think we will be involved in dealing with that. And we, I guess, since the way things unfolded in terms of the response to the emergency and the flooding in the southeastern part of the state, we felt most comfortable with working with DNR. It seemed to be a partnership that we had before, and it kind of fell into place. We do have intentions to do some work in Winona County, doing some GPS on assessing more of the damage there for the Winona County SWCD. We think Houston County will be talking to us more about work there too with their Saltwater Conservation District. We've been in, and that's why I wish the project manager was here. He's been in contact with them over the course of the last 45 days as they make their assessments and their plans and tend to come forward. In the Rook River Soil Water Conservation District, we did do work on the eroded banks. We spent 17 crew days in September and October there, and we also worked on some of the water control structures that were in the Rook River. The exact location, I'm sorry, I do not know that. And in the Crooked Creek Watershed District in Houston County, we spent 160 hours there removing debris and repairing major flood control devices. We also are teaming up with the Trails and Waterways folks in DNR to perhaps have a bigger part in snag removal in many of these waterways as a result of the flood. Their canoe routes or voting booths, and they're full of debris, even to this day. So there's going to be an effort, I think, on their part to come in and request additional funding for that. And we've had experience with that. I think we had a crew for about a month in the Rum River last year doing that kind of work, so we're familiar with how to do that. And we'd like to do it too. Energetic young people. I'm glad that Senator Jeffrey mentioned Maurer County. I was at the Saltwater Conservation District annual conference, and I was here in the legislative halls for a long time, and did a lot of work with saltwater conservation folks, but there's been some turnovers, and there were folks that came up to me and said, "You're with MCC, boy, you do nice work." That's what we like to hear, and that's what we like to tell you, that, you know, we are good investments, and we want to continue to carry that reputation, but to do the work for the folks that we all want to serve. So I'm open to any questions.
Any questions?
The brochure that I gave you outlines the process for contacting us. I thought you might like to see that. That's what we sent to the local units of government with names and numbers and, you know, the process. And then we just got, in the last couple weeks, this new brochure that we use for recruiting and interfacing with the public about our two programs. So we're hoping to be able to start another program for youth in the urban areas, and we didn't want to call it urban education, so we came up with youth outdoors with an exclamation mark becomes YO. And this seems to have a pretty good appeal to a lot of the inner city youth. We're hoping to pilot a program with the city of St. Paul come this it'll be in April and May. And St. Paul has got a former MCC-er as the director of their parks and rec area, and they know about our work and what we do with young people, so we're really excited about that. And one of the projects we did complete too, by the way, with before the season got bad, was some of a rather extensive amount of work in Cone Park. As you recall, the wind damage there was very, very extensive, and in the process of cleanup, there was a lot of heavy equipment that damaged a lot of the tanks of the place itself in the past, and so we did some quick fixes to that. Thank you very much, and we're always happy to come and visit, so just let us know. Representative Hansen and Representative Genius, thank you very much for your help again in getting that language into the bill in my session.
I was going to say there might be some opportunity in Mendota Heights with the pilot knob on some restoration there. In West St. Paul or South St. Paul, I'm sure there's some work too. So Youth Outdoors might be a good program for some of those first-tier suburbs as well. So
very good.
Be happy to talk to you about that.
And in that request.
We do like to hear these. I mean, it's only been a few months since the session started, but this is exactly the type of thing we were hoping for, is that you'd have the agencies and the nonprofit and the local units of government working together. And the flood was a terrible thing, but it shows that, you know, here's an opportunity to demonstrate how you guys can work together. And there are going to be disasters that come along every now and then, and this gives them an example of how things can happen in the future too. So we're very pleased by how things are working.
Very good. Thank you very much. And have a happy holiday.
Okay, Mr. Kohler.
Mr. Chairman, subcommittee members, and others in attendance, my name is Tim Kohler. I work for the U.S. Department of Natural Resources, U.S. Department of Agriculture, it's been a long day, sorry, Natural Resources Conservation Service, and one of my primary jobs is to administer all the Farm Bill programs that come to the state. Just as a quick recap, for the 2002 Farm Bill that we're just finishing up on, we've received in the neighborhood of $50 million a year for the last 6 years, including a little bit more this year. So we've probably brought close to $350 million to landowners in the state to implement conservation programs. So very substantial, many partners, including the landowners themselves. So just to give you a kind of a perspective. Representative Hansen had asked me to give you an update upon where we are today as well as where we may be going in relation to the federal farm bill and other programs. And so I wanted to do that briefly for you. In the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP for short, as many of you have heard of, is the major cost share program that we have with landowners. Last year in our appropriation bill, Congress was able to extend that to 2012, so that wasn't adversely affected by not having a farm bill. So we received $25 million allocation here about 2 months ago. We've had sign up already, and just in November alone, we've had enough applications to fully allocate all those funds and obligate those monies. So it's amazing the amount of people who are out there who want to do conservation projects. We're continuing to accept sign-ups because there's a chance my boss, Bill Hunt, is one who always asks for more money. He's already asked for more money, so there's a chance we'll be getting more money, Bill, to try to take care of conservation work that will occur into the future. As a couple of people have already mentioned, we've had some programs begin to or have already expired with the Farm Bill. Back in the end of our fiscal year, September 30th, we have a wildlife habitat program, an EQIP ground and surface water program, the Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program that's primarily Dakota County right now, as well as the Grassland Reserve Program, all expired. So we have no ability to deal with new projects with any of those programs until something happens with the Farm Bill. On December 31st of this year, the CRP program, Conservation Reserve Program, as well as the Wetlands Reserve Program expire. So with those programs here in another week, week and a half, we'll have no ability to work on new projects with those either until we get some action from Congress and the President. We also have a program, as many of you have heard of, called the Conservation Security Program, which is kind of a program that pays landowners who are continuing to do conservation on their land. That program is kind of in between the two. We have authorities to continue to pay existing contracts, but really not much of an expansion of the existing program, and that also will be tied to the new farm bill. So looking into the future then, and that future could be weeks away, months away, or possibly years away, I just don't know. We could have a new farm bill, as many of you have heard about. One thing we could do is Congress and the President could agree to extend the existing farm bill for a period of time, a year or longer, or there could actually be no action. As John Jaffe mentioned, we call this the Farm Bill, but it's the Farm Nutrition and Bioenergy Act, and if you look at the conservation funding part of it, it's about this big compared to food stamps and commodity payments and everything else, so and bioenergy and other energy resources now that are being all talked about. So this is a massive act that covers much more than just conservation, you know, with producers, with landowners, but it's important to point out. Most of you know that the Senate recently passed their version. The House already has their version. So after the holidays, then, they'll be trying to get together in conference an act that they can both live upon. It has to then go back to the full House, the House and the Senate, who then have to vote. Then it must go to the President for signature. You can all guess how easy all that will be, right, from all of your efforts. You know, the ideal or the most optimistic concept will probably be us having a new farm bill as early as February or March, potentially. Some people are trying to talk about an Easter farm bill. You know, I'm not sure exactly when. The big issue will obviously be is whether the President and Congress and Senate can reach agreement or whether they're going to fight over this and use this as a interesting levering point. So it will be interesting to see what happens. But the bottom line is, you know, we're all hoping for a new farm bill within the next few months. Now, as I mentioned, if it looks like we're not going to get that, and one of the challenges with the farm bill is obviously it also impacts commodity payments. And I don't work a lot with those, but there's farmers down south that are getting ready to plant pretty soon, I mean, within a month or two. And so there's a lot of discussion of doing an extension for a period of time, like I said before. If the farm bill is extended, say, for the 2008 year, and they extend programs that I just talked about have expired, then we'll more than likely receive the same amount of funding we received last year
for all these programs. And so, for instance, for the Wetlands Reserve Program, where I had almost $17 million, we've already been told if it's extended, we're probably getting between $15 and $20 million of WRP funds, just as an example. So we really don't know what might happen, but if it is extended, the Farm Bill, then obviously, we'll kind of tread water with another year, which for us, we received $50 million last year totally, so that'd be an all right way to tread for a year until Congress and the President could figure out what to do. Much better than no action, which would kind of stalemate us and have a whole year, a hiccup almost, of not much conservation put on the ground. So, in Representative Hansen and others, as we've talked before, as we get closer to the Farm Bill and when we know more about what's going to be looking like, I'm sure prepared to provide you whatever information and help you can to help decipher what's there, the pieces that are going to benefit. There's just so much potential, to collaborate, obviously, with the state. A couple of quick goals that maybe I would say, and then I'll stop talking so I can make sure I leave some room for some questions. I think that it's been a real exciting last 3, 4, or 5 years of continued partnership with the state, and a couple of really kind of glowing examples is our great efforts with the state on an easement work. The RIM WRP efforts that we've had together have really leveraged both programs, gotten a lot of great conservation on the ground, a lot of habitat restored, and if we didn't have the RIM program, for instance, to match the WRP funds, we would have lost a lot more than the money that we lost last year. We would have lost over $20 million versus just the 13 that we lost, which was a sin that we lost that, but it's the way it happened. So we're really looking for the future to continue that partnership with the Bowser Board and the staff. So that's an exciting thing that we continue to hope to look for. Washington is excited about it. It's one of the reasons we get more funding, because they like what we're doing together. We're leveraging each other's programs, both technical and financial, I might add. So the dollars are definitely going further. And the other one, as Mr. Jaskey already mentioned too, the leveraging between state cost share programs and the EQIP program, for instance, the Environmental Quality Incentive Program. Most of our programs with the cost sharing are limited. Roughly about 50% of the cost is what we're sort of mandated from Washington to cost share on. Well, when the state can come on top of that and add another 25%, it makes many projects viable to that landowner, where maybe at 50% it isn't a viable option for them. They can't afford it. So that's another partnership that we once again continue to look forward to and continue to hope to work together on. My last point to you, and once again, Mr. Jaskey mentioned it, the whole changing landscape is something that my boss, Bill Hunt, is very conscious of. If we begin to lose lots and lots of acres of temporary program payments like CRP, for instance, and get plowed up into corn or other crops, there's definite benefits of that, but there's also definite challenges with that. And so we're really pushing the idea of going back to remembering about conservation planning and trying to control soil erosion and trying to control chemical loss off of the fields, etc., as we move into this period of people more than likely plowing up more and more CRP land, for instance, because with the price of corn and the price of land and everything else, there's a lot of value into growing crops on some of that land versus leaving it in as wildlife habitat or erosion control or whatever. So we're really trying a concerted effort to say, it's your land, it's your choice what you do, obviously, but if you do it, let's look at some of these cost share programs, let's look at some ways you can manage residue and rotate crops and other things to try to minimize environmental impact, because we could have a lot of negative impacts if we're not careful. So I think with that, I will stop, Mr. Chairman, and see if there's any questions.
Any questions?
You had a question, but an observation. Our neighbor at our farm has gone out, whatever program he's been on, say, I don't know what his neighbor, to plant corn. It's going to be about, I think, 72 new acres into corn. And the reason isn't actually the corn. The reason is that he had thistles on his land and didn't know how to deal with the thistles. And folks didn't help him deal with the thistles. They just said, you got to get rid of those thistles. And there was a long kind of battle back and forth instead of having that kind of work to say, okay, here's how you do the thistles, just mow the things down. I can tell you some kind of horror stories about it. One of them is actually on the internet that NPR covered, but I don't want to blame all of the land going out of programs just on the price of corn. This guy actually, I think, wanted to stay in because it's just a group of hunters that have a big hunting shack. It's an old farmhouse, and it's a hunting shack. And they couldn't deal with government.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, we've been, and again, my boss, Bill Hunt, is a national champion of our agency with invasive species and different control stuff. And one of the things that, and I respect that person's frustration, because between the state laws and the county weed inspector and et cetera, sometimes people are forced into corners that they don't have much choice but to do certain things. And luckily, we don't regulate on noxious or invasive species ourselves. But a couple of the things that we've been trying to do is we're working with a number of the chemical companies and a number of the universities on mechanical types of control methods. And as you know, we've talked before, we have actually been part of EQIP. We have a cost sharing to help control invasive species using a variety of methods. You know, the challenge becomes, you know, again, how much of a priority is it and how easy is it to do? We're running into this on a lot of our easement lands, and I've provided testimony to some of the committees in this room. As we begin to plant the native equipped type seeds and everything else, when we get the more competitive invasive types of species like thistles and buckthorn and some of the others, we have to take some pretty drastic management measures, or they will take over until we get that native species established. So that's one of the things that we really challenge on. But I can understand your frustration looking at that, because I would sure provide a number of alternatives, including possibly cropping something when it has thistles to it. So,
if you like that frustration, can I give you another one?
I would love to.
Sure. The same county. Apparently, the township folks are just paid to spray along the township roads, which is about as county productive as you can get. You spray, well, something's going to come back and it's going to be weeds because you didn't plant anything else. So we have been on a continual, okay, stop spraying the stuff that we actually planted there. When are we going to get away from that? I mean, you talk about you're working with chemical companies, but it doesn't work to work with the chemical companies if our protocol is spray in the fall, spray in the spring, spray in the fall, spray in the spring, and that's it.
Chairman Hansen and Representative Wiggins, it's almost a rhetorical question because I really can't hardly respond to what to, but the issue that I think the challenge that I have when we work with private landlords, obviously, it's their choice to do what they want to do. But, the chemical part of it is, I'm not a big proponent of it, especially with a lot of our sites, because most of the chemicals that you use will kill some of the good stuff, too. And like our forbs and our flowers and other things on a lot of our easements, we don't like to use chemicals on them because it will kill them, too. So we really have to be careful using fire and mulling, and we've even used controlled grazing on some sites in a flash method to try to control some of this. The roadside, it's a complex issue that I'm not that involved in, but I'm sure it deals with budget and ease where they just run over it and not have to think about it much. That's sorry, I can't add more.
Well, you're probably right, it's budget and needs, but the consequence is that our roadsides are the places where the weeds are propagated.
Yeah.
It's not the farm site,
right.
And they can't control their weeds as long as you have these long weed patches running up to the farm site. And that's what it is. And they've got thistles in them and all sorts of other interesting things, none of which are, it's just, it's not, somehow we've got to get out of this cycle into some other cycle because we're hurting each other.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if you were here when I mentioned the county weed management cooperative program that's just being launched, and if this particular county has got some interest in that, maybe they could be encouraged to
Douglas.
I knew it started with a D. I think maybe I can see if there's a way for the Soil and Water Conservation District to stimulate a conversation about whether there's interest or not, at least getting that going. I think part of that cooperative is to do it, but it's also to help with the education about what to do and, of course, what not to do. So that's the hope for that new program, is to get more of those partners and other collaborators that are either responsible for eradication or responsible for preservation of the good stuff together and figure out how to do it best in their particular place. So we'll all have a conversation with someone in the county and see if they're willing to take a look at that.
If I could, my guess is it's township by township, and they get their money through probably the road folks, if I look at the county next door, at Grant County, they're very good about mowing their weeds, but they just have weeds. It's an amazing, when you get as far as the eye can see.
As long as you're both there, though, I have a couple questions for you. Mr. Kohler, Mr. Daske talked a little bit earlier about the cost share, the buffer program that we initiated, and when we debated that committee, and I realize you are with NRCS and not with FFA, and FFA does the CRP program, but where's the opportunity for interaction between the state buffer cost share and some of the federal NRCS programs?
Mr. Chairman, subcommittee members, there's almost unlimited amount of potential. First of all, and the Bowser staff have used our standards. We're kind of all agreeing upon the same type of standards to use for the planting and site prep and species and all the rest of it. Really, on that particular program, there's no reason why we couldn't provide 50% cost sharing, through the EQIP program. State cost sharing through the buffer initiative, the new initiative, spend some money on it also and make the dollars go that much farther. So we're already doing it on a limited basis, primarily riparian areas, turn roads, some areas like that. In a lot of cases, because we don't pay a rental payment on it, we just pay the cost share part of it, it may not be as attractive for a landowner to do it, but we've done quite a bit in the Northwest with some of the sugar beet lands and some of the other specialty crops. We've had some initiatives up there for some cover crops, especially in the riparian areas. So we're already starting to do it, and really the potential is a priority practice for us, and it would rank really high and be funded. I mean, it would be a easily funded a joint effort to do it. And our lifespan on that particular patch is only 10 years, but if it went 15 years, it'd be fine with us. I mean, that would be about the only thing I see as different, that really, if the landowner is willing to do it, we would be encouraged to have it be there that much longer. So,
yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think that's a pretty comprehensive response. The only thing I would add was, if we get new funding to Remus Minnesota program to go partner with the federal WRP dollars on wetland restoration, we could use some of that native buffer funding to enhance the areas, both wet and upland prairie areas that would be in the buffer areas around those wetland restorations. So, and that would stretch those easement dollars further to get more acres and also then establish higher quality vegetative communities than we would probably otherwise have been able to justify with the current programs that we have. So I can see a couple other ideas that we could also build it into as well.
And then with the December 31st approaching, let me just, so the farm bill, those programs will expire. But there's a continuing resolution for money that's not going to extend the farm bill program. So what you have on December 31st is, until there is a new farm bill or an extension, you'll be implementing those people who have signed contracts. And there's nobody new coming in who could partner with the state cost share dollars that we provide. Is that correct?
Chairman Hansen, that's pretty much true. The only exception would be on the EQIP program. As I mentioned before, we've already gotten $25 million, and we're right now partnering on Southeast Flood and on drought work and then other state cost share. So other than that program, but again, we've already pretty much got commitments from farmers for all of, or landowners for all of that money. So, but you're correct. Until we receive a new farm bill, obligating new money for conservation would be on hold until we either get an extension or a new farm bill. But again, and one point I would just add too, especially on the WRP side of things, WRP is one of the strongest programs in all three pieces, in the House, Senate, and the administration's proposal. It's there at existing levels or higher. So, and again, we've been using the top three in the country of WRP funding, partly because of your efforts with partnership. So I feel pretty confident that if we get an extension or a new farm bill, WRP is going to, Wetlands Reserve Program is going to be one of those that's going to pretty well survive. There's been lots of discussions on other programs of putting stuff together and tearing stuff apart and everything else, but WRP has been pretty strong. It's got a pretty strong interest. Mm-hmm.
And if we had RIM dollars, additional RIM dollars in a bonding bill, that still could be matched with WRP if there is a new farm bill. But the existing farm bill and WRP end in a week and a half. So if we pass something in April or May, we can't match yet until we get a federal new bill.
Chairman Hansen, that is a true statement. One of the good things that we have is one of the good things that came out of last year's disaster for us of having to turn back $13 million was that we have about almost 100 appraisals, current appraisals that are good for a year with landowners that we could almost immediately go back to and say, if we have the funding through our new farm bill, we could go back almost immediately to them and offer them a RIM WRP easement. And a lot of those people would accept, and we could really probably obligate the money in a short few months' time versus starting from fresh applications right from the start. So that's one positive with having all those people say no to just WRP from last year. So, but again, we are waiting. We have to have it for the new farm bill, because I do not have any money after, well, really right now I don't have any more money.
And then with Mr. Jackson, with CREP ending on December 31st, if you haven't encumbered the money, then you can't match the federal money. So what happens with the money if we haven't encumbered, and will there be any money that's not encumbered on December 31st in CREP?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is the only money that won't be encumbered is the money that we're holding for the Southeast Flood Response. Everything else, we made an obligation that was based on the funds that NRC has had to line up with the WRP funds that they had until the end of the year. A little more comment, too, if you wouldn't mind. Back to the Native Buffer Program, certainly we want to line up with some federal programs, but it also would work in representabilities there and other places where you've got lakeshore areas that could benefit from native plant communities being established in very small amounts, but if you do it in a lot of places, those can become very important plant communities for lakeshore protection, as well as, the riverine areas, which are often thought of as longer strips. But we're going to have that funding out to all of the state areas that are eligible, including basically an area from, Chisago County through Benton and up through Morrison and Todd, and then going up straight north, basically through Roseville County. So we expect that some of those areas will become lakescaping type projects too, if interest is shown. So they're also eligible.
That's good to hear.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you for coming to the committee.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Any other? We did hand out the campaign finance disclosure memo relating to the public official disclosure, and I think everybody has a copy of that. Shows a relatively small percentage of public officials who haven't filed their statements of economic interest. Does anybody have a copy of that? Mm-hmm. Any other questions? As I mentioned, we will be meeting on Wednesdays. Dennis, is that right? On Wednesdays. So we'll have a meeting that first Wednesday of the session. That'll be going over the legislative audit report, and then we'll be subsequently going over a number of reports that are due and looking at any proposed legislation that might be coming our way. So with that, I adjourn the committee.